So, they put us in the mega room. It's a little freaky. They also gave us this title, a postmortem. It's a little unusual to do a postmortem for a product that is still in alpha. No, we're not dead yet. We're actually still just getting going. We're in closed alpha. But many of you probably noticed the theme for GDC this year is basically democratization of user content. That's why we're seeing stuff like XNA Creators Club announcements and Sims Carnival and all these other really wonderful things popping up. And so that's why we're here, even though we're not done yet, really. It's in order to show you some of the stuff we're working on, because that's really what we're all about. That's really what we're trying to do here. So brief agenda, we're going to tell you why we're making what we're making. Then we're going to show it to you, which is pretty cool, because I know a lot of people have not gotten the chance to see it. Even though it's not done, it's still pretty neat. And then we're going to spend, hopefully, most of our time on actual post-mortem, like hardcore developer stuff. This is not a sales pitch talk. We're actually here to talk about what went right, what went wrong, and what our development processes were. So, given the crowd, you'd rather have that than a sell job, yes?
Yes.
All right, good.
And questions.
Oh, and questions. And apparently questions. We're the last talk of the day, so unless you have to catch a flight, we can hang around. So, all right, the first question, subtitle, why reinvent MMOs? Because currently making MMOs kind of sucks. Any of you making MMOs? Yeah, it's kind of like pushing the 2,000-ton boulder uphill, isn't it? They're just too hard to make these days. And what's worse, each one of them's like this moonshot, right? You're building every little piece by hand from scratch every time. And on top of that, they kind of work like Prodigy. We have not really had significant advances in MMO or virtual world architecture at a really fundamental reinvention level since basically 1978. They just haven't changed that much. We're just making MUD 203 instead of MUD 2. They're kind of like the hypertrophied version or something. We all know the consequences of this, right? They're getting insanely expensive to build. Now, I'm talking here of traditional MMORPGs. There's lots of really cool stuff on the web that's getting done by folks like Gene Androdi in his basement. You in here, Gene? Yeah, everybody point at Gene. Hi, Gene, who actually did build a 1.8 million user MMO in his basement. So it can be done, but for the mainstream industry, it's gotten really insanely hard. Plus, most of us are not Gene, which is a problem. The other problem with something that expensive is that if you got to get it perfect, you launch badly and it's all over, right? And it's, what was it Gordon used to say, pile up $20 million and set it on fire? Except these days it's more like $30, $40, $50 million and setting it on fire. We also keep reinventing the wheel, and all of these things lead to publisher pressure, which says, make it like WoW. Have any of you in the room had that phrase said to you recently? So, how MMOs work today? Sean, you've built a few of these. How do they work today?
So, I'm Sean Riley. I'm the lead programmer at Metaplace. I've worked at NCSoft, I worked at Origin for a while, and I've done some other sort of back-end stuff. I worked at SegaSoft back in the day and on a game called 10-6, which no one remembers. So I've seen lots of back-end technologies for MMOs, and they're really complicated. They're big, they're very tightly integrated, they take lots of machines to run, and they're very monolithic, and they're not very reusable. So,
what's it, Lineage 1 to Lineage 2? That's one.
Right, so can anyone think of examples of reuse of MMO server technology?
Just not real common, right? Lineage 1 to Lineage 2, I guess Dark Age of Camelot was actually built on top of an old MUD server, their older version.
Right. And as technology has progressed over the last 20 years, some of the constraints that are built into these systems for performance have been relaxed a little bit. So the idea that we have to tightly couple all the data protocols between the client and the server into a really tight binary pipe, the way people were writing FPS games 15 years ago, it may be not so true anymore. So there's room to add some flexibility to the system.
So let's take a little trip down memory lane. Back in the MUD days, it kind of looked like this. You had a client. It was called Telnet. And you had a server which had, you know, rooms. And you could talk. And eventually, you could save your game, your character. It didn't start that way, by the way. And of course, there was game logic. There are a couple of other things in here. That's not really what it looks like today, right? A modern MMO server cluster. You have a kind of this multiplexing user server architecture where you have to come in and get multiple connections that multiplex out to multiple world servers, each of which is managing different chunks of the map or different clusters of users. You have the static database, of course, and the runtime database. One of these is source data. The other is your persistence database. Often these days, you have to run a global chat server that cuts across all of the pieces, and that means since you're running all of these servers, you need to have a process manager to make sure they're all running. That usually means you have to bridge over to your web authentication, which then is a separate server system, add the RMT market system, then the Armory and metadata, and of course a whole separate system for patching. So it's gotten a little bit complicated, and of course you need all of that per shard, which...
So how many shards are there for WoW now?
Oh, God, I don't remember. Yeah, globally. Yeah. A lot, yeah. So the interesting thing is we're trying to solve, you know, this kind of distributed, complicated, multi-user computing problem, right? It turns out that somebody already built one that does all of this stuff, that's cheap, has scaled enormously, has managed to be pretty future-proof. You can reuse chunks of it. And every single one of you uses it every day. For all I know, some of you are using it right now. Guesses? The web. The web. So, how many of you work actively with web technology today? Quite a lot of you. Good. Good. Because we're going to start... From this point forward, if you don't, please turn to your neighbor who just raised their hand and ask them anytime you get lost. This is why the web works today. Pretty much each one of these pieces is indispensable. Okay? So, from top to bottom, there's an open markup language, HTML. That means that anybody can write a browser. The original one was kind of the original Mozilla code base, became the reference browser for everything. There's Apache. There are other web servers, but Apache, I think at this point, is, what is it, 70% of the web? Something like that.
A lot.
That really doesn't make that many assumptions about what kind of web content you're going to serve up, right? If it did, then the web would be much narrower in focus than it is today, right? It supports extensions to behavior via CGI. CGI is like all those .php, .whatever URLs, right? Which is, they're just scripts, really. They're, you know, behavior plugins for the server. The web is reskinnable using CSS and style sheets and things like that. And it's easy to make templated content for the web. Of course, the internet as a whole is distributed and segmented. That's really different from how we build MMOs, right? All web servers are not still hosted at CERN in Switzerland. They let them get hosted elsewhere, thank goodness, right? And a single website does not attempt to hold the entire internet. Which, again, that's pretty different from how we do things in virtual worlds. All of this beautiful richness would be horrible if you couldn't find anything. And that's why the things like Google and Yahoo and YouTube and all of these other services are so important. Because they provide you ways to actually locate what you want. So the question is, if you were trying to make an MMO that got you these benefits, what would it look like? Instead of this, we think it looks like this. And this is pretty much what the server graph for a Metaplace architecture looks like. And when we did this, we consciously went back to this and copied each of these steps. And we're going to walk you through our development process in copying each of those steps. Now, this does mean we have a core philosophical difference with many of the MMOs out there. We think, with apologies to Neil Stephenson, that Snow Crash is a lie.
There is no spoon.
There is no spoon.
Yeah, you know, it's almost impossible to think these days. When you look at the whole web, the idea of cramming the internet into one world is starting to look not just silly, but kind of pointless, right? Because we like things like using our iPhone to walk around downtown San Francisco to figure out where the hell the Three Rings Party is, right? The idea of having to log into a virtual world and then walk to where that map is kind of sucks, right? And we're heading for a future where really virtual worlds, virtual places do offer something new, but we're heading for a future where they're going to be first-class citizens on the web, right next to movies, right next to streaming audio, right next to pictures, and right next to text. Just another kind of media on the internet. And that's really the reverse, kind of. It's like Snow Crash flipped inside out. The nice thing, of course, is that we in this room can bring things to the table on this that the web doesn't know how to do, but they really, really want to do. So now comes the scary bit. We are going to actually show you... Now, I got to caveat this. We're still in alpha. If it blows up, please forgive us. We promise we will keep working on it. What you're seeing here is a full-blown multi-user MMO running on a web page in Flash. We're walking around, and here's a bunch of our testers. The testers, say everyone to everybody at GDC.
Live at GDC.
Say hi to hundreds of people. Now, everybody right now looks like one avatar, because avatar customization isn't done yet. There they all go. Hi, hi. These are just some of our alpha testers. We've only let in a few hundred so far.
We told them not to do that, but...
Yeah. Now, the nice thing about running, you know, you've all seen web, you've all seen webkins, you've all seen stuff on the web, right? Club Penguin, whatever. So by itself, this isn't that big a deal. The thing is, we really work the way the web does. Anybody in here speak French? Any test? All right. Let's say hello to everyone. Don't typo it.
Thank you.
Everyone. Every phone. Right, so that was live, inline, real-time, reach out to Babelfish, get an answer, and stick it back in the chat.
And the server did that, not the client.
That's right.
And the code that did that on the server was written in our scripting language.
Which is just Lua, right? So, in other words, it's basically full, real-time web integration. It can reach out to anything. You want to... Any cool videos on YouTube these days?
And again, the server is going to search YouTube here, and it found some videos. So the web provides lots of asynchronous services through web services. There's things like looking at stock quotes and your typical web services, but we can integrate all that into a real-time game environment.
So here's the thing about a Metaplace server. Oh. It is a...
Right.
Yeah. A Metaplace server is a web server, and every object has a URL, and you can browse to it using a standard web browser from outside the world, or you can interact with it inside the world. And every object in Metaplace can browse the web itself and go out and interact with any web service that is on the internet. And we'll talk about this in a little bit, but just to bend your mind a little, a server will also be able to be a client of another world. So you can really start kind of pretzeling this in crazy ways. Why don't we show something else? So this here's a little puzzle game which you can blame on Will Wright's talk about design inspirations a few years ago. So this is also the same client, the same server, in a completely different kind of environment. This is a puzzle game. That's because what we're building, like a web browser, makes no assumptions about what kind of world you're looking at, right? So you can make a single-player puzzle game in it that also happens to have MMO chat on the side and runs instances. So in other words, what we're building is trying to be client-agnostic. It's actually based on a markup language, just like HTML, And we are happy to tell you all that we are opening the standard for that client architecture, and we will be publishing core classes so that any of you can write clients in C++, Java, Lua, Python, JavaScript, or BASIC.
On any platform.
On any platform at all. Sure, let's go.
So here I clicked on a link, I got a page, I click play, and a totally different world pops up. It's going to load for a second here.
So everything here is actually being fetched by HTTP rather than streaming it in some custom format. Importing an item into Metaplace, a piece of art, is actually giving it the URL cut and pasted from Google Images. Because everything is, literally, the client is a web browser. It actually identifies the web servers that way. So here we are running this kind of subspacey kind of clone. Not quite done yet. We're going to be stress testing this guy in another couple of weeks publicly. But, you know, there's physics capabilities on the server on the back end and all of that. Now, what we've shown you has all been 2D, but the architecture of this is designed so that it could scale down to text or up to 3D. It really is designed to be representation agnostic in every way. So that you could, if you wanted, make a client that was, feeding out just RSS. Or maybe being an ad banner. Right? Really whatever you want, sitting on any web page anywhere. Full screen client if you want. You could write one in OpenGL and so on. So why don't you show them the My Meta, actually, which is pretty cool, too. Every Metaplace world exists in a network. You can walk from any one to any other one. They exist in one network, and you can have friends, and you can have all of those standard social networking systems. Even get presence feeds from all of your friends who are online anywhere in the network, click on their name, and teleport to that world wherever on the internet it happens to be running. Right, so that's kind of the advantage of doing things on the web way. All of these things are web services. Anybody can plug into them in any way. They're all open.
So you can put on FeedBurner where people have been.
Right. Of course, every world gets its own profile page with ratings, reviews, tags, metrics, forums, wiki, blah, 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 blah. All of those kinds of things that we kind of expect from the web these days. So enough demo, because again, we're not trying to sell you on stuff. We really want to talk about why we built it this way and where it's going. So these are kind of the core things, right? These are often not things we get to do in the game industry. We'll show you the iteration paths for some of these things in a minute, but really, we started from crazy, crazy simple and just did those iterative loops over and over and over again. Any particular technical things you want to say here? I put the decouple components line in here just for you.
Yeah, and web time is different from game time. And it's interesting to see the web people watching us and they think we're going really slow. And the game people seem to think we're going fairly quickly. Have a different perspective on things.
By separating out all of these components into individual modules, really, you can iterate on one while another one stays still, and then you can swap that one out completely. So a good example of this is how, you know, I showed you that stack, you remember, right? So the bottom layer of Metaplace is actually literally a markup language. And we started in my spare bedroom, working against a TextMud server and handwriting the tags into the static text files and writing a client that would then parse those tags. The tag structure was really, really rigid because we wanted to use split string for the fastest possible speed we could get. But of course, then Sean got a hold of it. And it started to evolve, right? So pretty soon here, we are moving to supporting multiple formats for tags. The one we have now, we call GML for Game Markup Language. You already saw that puzzle game, that arcade game, that virtual world were all represented using the same tag string. which was literally, it looks like open bracket, object here, close bracket, X, Y, Z, moving this way, facing that way, right? It doesn't even know what the object looks like. It doesn't have any assumptions about what you're going to do once you know it's there. The client might just spit out a line of text saying, this object's here, because that might be all it has the capability for. Of course, now we have the cool XML schema thing. Does everybody know what that means, XML schema?
It's like metadata to describe the structure of our protocol, and then we can use that to accelerate new clients because they can conform to the schema, and we can do code generation to create all your packet code for you and things like that. It really will be an accelerating tool for development of things on the platform.
Right. So what that means is that the way the tag stuff works is first we tell you, here's the language that we're going to agree to use to communicate, and you can just literally build a dynamic dictionary of that. So if we change the protocol, the client just knows. It doesn't need to be told. It doesn't need to be patched, right? It can just get updated pretty easily. And then it can be reformatted really easily into other languages and other formats. So, for example, our web tools take the same tag stream, but as bog standard XML via a web service. And they interact. So we basically have a JavaScript tools client that interacts in that way.
And clients can process only a small portion of the protocol if they want to. You can have a very simple client that just waits for specific tags and gives you notifications, things like that, for debugging or for creating load balancing, load testing clients, things like that.
Right. So the thing about that is that it's been incredibly efficient for us. We've been able to basically never break the network stream. Right. So if you guys have worked in MMOs before, you know about patching the server, patching the client at the same time, 8 hours of downtime, make sure everybody's consistent, all of that stuff. When a tag reaches our client, if the client doesn't know what it is, it just blows it off. It's like, whatever. I don't know what that is, so I'm not even going to bother. The iteration speed with which we've been able to add features, I would conservatively estimate at 10x what we have faced in the MMO world previously. It's just so much faster, I cannot tell you. When we say, hey, let's add a particle system or something, you literally just sit at your client and you echo tags to yourself until your system works. And then you put those tags in to be generated by the server. The lesson here is that these days we don't need to be hyper-obsessive about incredibly efficient, deeply packed binary protocols, this, that, and the other. You can connect to a Metaplace world via Telnet. And it will work, right? That's radical democratization. And the internet still runs on bog standard TCP for most of it. That means that we're basically still talking the basic lingo of the internet.
You know, you can tell that to a web server and type get /http:\.0 and you'll get a web page.
That's right. So Metaplace basically, again, it tries to work exactly the way the web does. So I realize this sounds very geeky. Those of you who are geeks and dig it, go ahead and go, yay. Yay, okay. Those of you who are completely lost, go, huh? Okay. The good news is, if you're just interested in doing something with Metaplace, you don't need to know any of this crap. So that's a good thing. I actually wrote the first Metaplace client in BASIC. Because, I get so lost with basic Windows classes and Visual Studio, I don't even know how to open a window. I learned BASIC. It was my first language in 1983 or whatever. But that first client, right, we're now starting on our fifth client in-house. So we make a client, and Sean makes a client because he's impatient with me, and then somebody else starts making a client. As of today, there's at least two testers who have written clients already in the last, 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Again, radical democratization, allowing anybody to participate in the process. Now, mind you, obviously, this is hardcore geeky types are going to be writing a client. The key lesson here is the reason why clients are so hard to make right now is that we pack them full of graphics, right? I mean, that's number one. And number two, we try to make them really, really smart because we think that's how we, optimize. And we said, you know, why? Why isn't a client today as simple as Telnet was really, really stupid? The benefit of it being stupid is that you can write it on darn near anything. You can put it on pretty much anything, a set-top box, a phone, if you believe Ray Kurzweil, on an implant in your contact lenses, you know, whatever, as long as it's got some processing power. For us, a client, you just have to, you need MD5, you need HTTPS, and you need a TCP socket. And that's pretty much all you need to be able to connect.
Some kind of graphics, maybe.
Maybe.
But not necessarily.
Text, yeah, even that.
Yeah.
How cool would it? You could write a Metaplace client that output everything as MIDI. It wouldn't be very playable, but you could do it. So the stupid client lesson has actually been really empowering for us because so much of our effort these days goes towards representation, right? So how many of you have kids? A lot of you. And have any of your kids, like, have you ever bought them, like, the plug-and-play Atari paddles or joystick or anything like that? Yeah? And did they play with them for a bit? Because the kids, they grew up, you know, we grew up with graphics changing all the time. So we actually think that shaders are better than not, and that polygons are better than 2D. But the kids, you know, it's like they were born and they first encounter video games, and to them that question is kind of like saying, what's better, jazz or classical? It's a stupid question, right? They'll say, well, Pong isn't actually better with 3D graphics. You know, Pong is good the way it was. And so my kids love playing Pong and then going straight to Halo 3. They don't make the distinction. So having clients that just say, hey, I'm a 2D client, that's how I operate, that's how I identify, having a different client that says, I'm 3D, that means I can draw the 2D stuff also, but I can also give you a better experience, and a phone that just says, well, I'll just show you the chat because that's all I can handle, right? Having stupid clients means you can be agnostic to clients. And that means that what you're looking at is a virtual world that's it's a multi-headed hydra that you can interact with on whatever sort of device you happen to have handy. So iterating over and over again on this was really, really good. Developing clients in parallel was very, very good. We would have, at one point, there were three clients in active development simultaneously, and all had different support for different tags. In terms of how we worked on the server, like I said, we started out with a TextMud. The basic technologies of virtual worlds really aren't that different from TextMuds, right? You're getting data sent to you over a stream, and then the client says, well, I'm going to draw this. We created the tag system against the TextMud server, and then we built a client, and then we removed the TextMud server, and we plugged in Thor's, Wave Thor, we plugged in Thor's server written in Twisted Python, and then Sean added scripting on top of that, and then we took out the Twisted Python piece but left the scripting in place, and Sean dropped in a C++ server. Right, see how decoupled it all is? Really, really big impact on the development process, as opposed to building something where everything shared common architecture.
Right. So there was, in all of this time, there was no code shared between the clients and the servers, just specifications.
That's right. Those of you who are programmer geeks in the room know what that means. It's actually a really, really radical shift, not assuming any code-based commonality. The C++ server eventually added what we call platform services. These are things that you really don't want to be in script and that you figure you want most worlds to use, right? Very, very common requests.
Yeah, and for us, the only things that have to be platform services are real-time services that interact very tightly with the simulation of the world. Pretty much everything else can live on the web.
All right, so what that means is everything that can be moved is. If it is asynchronous, you take it out of the server. Right? Again, those of you who are programmer geeks, you know, that means everything like authentication, even the translation, right? All of that stuff, you move it out of the server. You assume that the server is really, really stupid and thin. What's the executable size of our server, do you know?
It uses about 20 megabytes of memory.
Yeah. I bet the source code repository for WoW is bigger than that. Right? The client, by the way, is also so stupid that the Flash client's like 100K right now. Really, really, really thin. So the key thing here is make everything into an aggregator, right? Rather than trying to make the server into the central traffic cop of the universe. So then we put in Lua. Now, you may not know this, but Sean is actually the author of the book Game Programming in Python. And on the first day that he got to work, he said, let's use Lua.
I don't want to bash Python. Python's a good language. And it's, but there are times when different tasks call for different tools, and we thought in this case that in the embedded environment, Lua was a better choice. It's smaller, it's fast, it's easy to instance, it's easy to clean up entire instances of it and restart them, it's easy to integrate with C, and it's got many of the same advanced functional capabilities of Python, but without some of the drawbacks for the environment that we wanted to use it in.
Right. So the interesting thing about this, again, is the constant iteration loop, right? We were not shy about ripping out entire scripting systems, writing whole new ones, dropping them in, swapping out the entire server, right? So the interesting thing about this is that we said it's like CGI, except it actually is CGI, because the server is a web server. So that means, you know how you submit a form on the web? You can submit a form to a Metaplace door.
And it will generate HTML out, or XML, or JSON, or whatever you want.
Right. Again, it's literally CGI, not just hypothetically CGI.
Right.
The key thing here is realizing, you know, we're very used to, you know, there's this huge debate, right, about do you use scripting in MMOs, right? Any of you had this argument? A few of you, maybe? You're all asleep already. You want to fly home. I can relate. It is this huge debate. Do you script it? Do you use C++? If you let designers script it, they're going to screw it all up because they don't know how to code. I've heard many programmers make that argument. I've heard many designers say, yeah, but you don't ever implement what I want, so I have to do it myself. You know, kind of a bit of a culture war that goes on there. The reason to do the scripts is because they are small, they're atomic, they're little components. We have a system called modules where you can not only take a script from one Metaplace world to a completely other Metaplace world, but you can package up what we call a smart object. This podium with the microphone, its template, its scripts, its data, whatever, package it up and you can import it into the puzzle game. And it would work because of that common platform, because everything is so modular, right? So rather than building these mega gigantic AI systems, what our alpha testers are doing is actually bridging to external AI systems that live on other servers, which is kind of cool if you think about it, because it means that, let's say, somebody provides a cool AI system or a cool system for large-scale strategic gameplay or whatever it is, that can actually be implemented by somebody else, some other universe, right? Some other website. It's just an open common standard that any other game can share, rather than building these monolithic systems.
A little bit more on the data versus script debate. We can put data in your scripts, but if your data needs get beyond that, you can call out to an external data service and load that up when your script gets loaded.
Right.
So, best of both worlds.
So, a good, I mean, you saw the YouTube, you saw the translation, stock quotes, right? Getting the world's real-time weather and having that affect the virtual world's weather, right? Your grades affecting how your avatar looks. You know, whatever it is, you can pull in whatever data you want, including game data. We have one guy who has written a web service to do procedural generation of terrains and things like that, and he fetches in the terrains via a web service. So it's not even on the server generating the procedural maps. It just gets it from someplace else. CSS, this is kind of a complicated thing. When you define a world, you can read the definition of a Metaplace world in a flat text file. Because all it is a record of the tags that we would send to a server. including pointers to where the script is, pointers to where the assets are, that kind of thing. And any changes that happen on the fly happen by the tags. The client then goes and fetches everything it's been told to fetch. This is even to the point, the client doesn't even know that the up arrow means north. It gets told, I have a north command, and then it gets told, I would prefer if north is on the up arrow. And the client says, I'm a phone, I don't have an up arrow. I'll put it on my, you know, my closest analog to up, you know, whatever I've got on my little pad or whatever. On an iPhone, maybe it has it on the swipe up finger gesture, right? So the server doesn't even know how you're going to interact with what it's sending you, but it can send down recommendations. All of these kinds of things together we call the style sheet. And then you get the real-time stuff, which is also in exactly the same tag language. That means that if you use plain old text logging, you actually get a machinima playback client, because you can just feed a text log back into the client, and it'll just say, oh, that's what I saw, sure enough, and play it back for you. The key thing about this, the lesson here, is that you're separating completely what you draw from what's going on, right? And if you think about it, again, that's what the web does. The web cannot assume that its web page fits on your screen, right? It can't assume that you have the ability to draw an image. You know, on every Mac, you can still open up a command line and type links and browse the web in text. And it still works. And it's because of the separation of rendering from behavior. So this, I realize, especially there's game designers in the room, right? This is scary. Because we're used to thinking of the interface being where the rubber meets the road, right? The button press, whatever. And what this architecture says is, no, you do not get to control the interface at all, right? And that, anybody else freaked out? I mean, it freaks me out as a game designer, right? It's like saying, oh yes, you can play Guitar Hero, but they might be playing it on a piano. And, you know, it's just not up to you. So that's a pretty radical shift, actually. It has interesting implications for game design, that you just don't know what the client facing for a given world or a given game or experience might be. The beautiful part of it is that then some guy comes along and makes a client that represents it in some crazy-ass way that you never thought of. Like maybe he measures user chat on an oscilloscope. And who, you know, whatever. And we'll learn crazy stuff about how people do things and what they do because we didn't force them to look at the world in only our way. Again, you know, democratizing content cuts both ways. We lose a little bit of our control in the process, but we get a lot of cool capabilities back. DNS. You guys all know what DNS is? Good. So, name service, basically. I remember when I first got on the net, you too probably, right? I remember sending email to my friends and having to actually type, okay, send it to the gateway at BitNet and then send it through to the next gateway at NSFNet, which happens to bridge over to the ARPANET so that it can route through this piece of the backbone and then it can get back on NSFNet, which that school happens to be on. You used to have to actually know all of that shit. You had to tell it the routing. We don't anymore. Usually what you see today, maybe, you've probably seen typing in an IP address, right? That's because name service has kind of covered all of that stuff up. It's still going on behind the scenes. When we started, we connected to a single TextMud server. Today, we can have a Flash client running off of a web server in Atlanta that requests a world from the domain name service in Utah, which tells it, oh, the world you want is running on my wife's Mac behind a Time Warner cable modem in San Diego. Connect and ask for all of the assets from PhotoBucket. Right? And the way we did that, we started out with distributed servers where we actually had to type in the addresses by hand. And then WNS started sending us lists and saying, oh, this is where that lives. And eventually we had too many worlds. There are hundreds of worlds on the Metaplace network at this point. Most of them are crap. You don't want to go there. But they exist. And we changed over to a name service thing. Hello?
Hello?
We have lost our routing.
Need a microphone name service.
Yeah, microphone name service needed. So what ended up happening is you request a particular world, and it tells you how to connect, where to go.
All right. Because that world...
You don't have it either.
I can't
check,
talk.
Check. Sorry. We'll shout!
Because worlds could be running anywhere. And at different times, the same world could be running in a different location. If you do load balancing across multiple machines, instances of the world start up, they shut down. So you need to know where they are at any point of time.
Yes, the key lesson here is don't try to cram the internet into your platform. The internet is providing all of these other features that you can use. So use them. Don't reinvent what's already been done. Hello. You're here to save us from microphone. It just
is
went
mine working?
Mute.
Mine's not working anymore.
It's, not, it's way quieter somehow. Ah, we've lost the connection to the house system and the monitors are still working. Democratize technology support in action. So, not cramming the internet into your platform has a lot of really beneficial effects. For one thing, it saves you about 9/10 of the work. Metaplace was mostly built, started in January of 07 with one programmer, and ended 07 at about 10, 11 people, and that's including community manager and so on. And yet we have a server system that supports thousands of concurrent users and all the rest, because we offloaded as much as we could onto the web rather than doing it ourselves. Finally comes the last piece, which is kind of our Google equivalent. Originally, you could actually hit, and any of you ever visit my website? RafKoster.com? If you knew, you could have gone to RafKoster.com/this special little directory, and you could have actually seen,
there.
No, I'm not going to say where it was. You would have actually seen the early version of the portal running there. Because it was about a 30-line PHP script that kept track of where all of the worlds were that were running. And all it did was spit back literally the style sheet data in giant blocks. Because we fetched the definition of puzzle game versus RPG literally as a text file off of that web page. Then Sean came and once again fixed what I had done.
I can't talk.
No, oh, you can't talk because you have no microphone. And broke it into two pieces, right? Portal and style sheet. Basically, by separating these two, we built web services on top of the style sheet stuff, which created a database of what the worlds were. And we built a website that surfaced all of the metadata about the worlds. Things like who's playing and where those worlds are running and what the ratings are, what the reviews are. And at this point, we've started adding Web 2.0 features to portal stuff all over the place. And what's coming is web services so that you can see that portal data from anywhere. You could go write your own Metaplace portal, if you so choose, because most of that stuff is just surfaced via web services. The lesson here is it's no good if you can't find stuff in friends. And this is actually an interesting problem in the MMOs where everything is sharded.
Nope.
Everything is separated. You level up in one world, you can't visit another world, that kind of thing. Because at this kind of meta level, we have your network level identity, we can put in things like a meta identity. We like using the word meta. A meta identity, and then you can have separate identities per world, even many of them if you have separate characters. We can have a network level reputation, network level ratings for your activities, network level virtual currency, network level services of various sorts that a world can optionally tap into. And if they want to go do their own thing, they can do their own thing. We don't really care. But the nice thing about that is that unlike the scenario where your friend's on a different server than you, in a Metaplace world, you can check the presence feed, click on their name, and it doesn't matter what world they're in. You can jump to them. So one world might be Tetris, one world might be WoW. You just go to wherever they are, anywhere across the network. So what went right? Right? This is post-mortem-y, right? So what went right? using the web solution whenever it's available. Do not reinvent the wheel, right? The one significant case where we chose to ignore something from the web... Hey, is this working now? Woo!
Am I working now? Oh, I'm back.
Way!
Hello!
Still only in the monitor.
Oh, but the monitors are louder. That's good. The one significant case where we invented something new was actually the tag language. And that's because the web solutions for that tended to be about four times too heavy in real-time bandwidth. XML, even JSON was a bit too heavy. We really wanted something that was really fast, really rigid, while still being human readable, so it could be parsed really fast. The next thing was, we didn't try to solve everything. We would pick a piece of content, we would develop against it, we'd do the functions that needed to be done just to solve that, and then we would move on. To this day, we do not try to solve server clusters and multi-server. We're making stuff for end users. Not too many of them need 1,000 concurrent standing on one square inch. So just don't solve it yet. Don't over-design. Keep it really simple. Keep it stupid. Tags was probably the key thing that made this all work from the beginning. Realizing, hey, here's this architecture that has served the web incredibly well, breaking out of the notion of rigid network protocols. Just the fact that our network's team never breaks. You have no idea how nice that is. From an HR perspective, we were really, really picky about hiring. We grew really, really slowly. We added generally no more than one person a month, added them carefully to the team culture, because half of our team is web and half of our team is game people. And the two worlds don't actually talk to each other very much right now. That's changing, but right now they almost speak different languages. Whoa, thank you. Yay for the AV people. So they almost speak different languages. We use a system where every time we interview somebody, every employee at the company gets to rate them from minus 10 to plus 10. And we got this system from Rich Vogel. Is Rich here? I don't know. Minus 10 means I quit if you hire this person. And 10 means I quit if you don't hire this person. And we will not hire anybody who doesn't get a 5 average. And that has been incredibly important to maintaining kind of the shared culture and the shared vision. Being multi-client early forced us to be honest and eat our own dog food, right? It was a massive pain in the ass.
Yeah. If you can imagine building 4 concurrent clients for your MMO instead of 1 client for your MMO, it's not quite the same problem, but it's similar.
Similar.
All in different languages.
Sometimes different operating systems.
Right.
Yeah. And in the case of something like Flash, you're working across, you know, it's some like 9 or 10 browser combinations across browsers and OS. But it forced us to be honest about client agnosticism, about distribution, about keeping the client really simple. I don't know how many times we were tempted to say, let's just make the client a little more complicated, a little smarter, and we backed away from it, in part because one of the various client writers would go, oh, but that piece is really hard in Flash. Or that piece is really hard in BASIC.
And it's amazing the stuff that's really hard in Flash.
Yes. We could probably talk for you about an hour about that.
Yeah, stuff that we take for granted in games is sometimes really hard in Flash. And stuff that's really easy in Flash is sometimes really hard in games. So we needed to find Flash people who had gaming backgrounds, and we couldn't find any, so we had to train them, basically.
And the final lesson from this was really counterintuitive to a lot of gaming audience, I think, which is don't optimize, right? Now, actually, this is a really old lesson. It was first stated formally, rule number 1 of software development, don't optimize yet, and rule number 2, don't optimize at all, something like that.
That's backwards, but fine.
Yeah. You know, the tag stream is nowhere near as efficient as it could be. But the fact is, you know, if you tried connecting using Telnet to an MMO, we did in UO, it was really, really laggy. But the infrastructure is just better. You know, it swallowed up a lot of the difference. Optimization too early tends to lock you in because you make choices for your current situation. rather than for unforeseen situations. So by leaving things not performing as well as they could, you actually open up a lot of possibility and a lot of potential for people.
And optimizations are often platform specific, and we obviously can't really take advantage of those across the whole network, so putting them in is counterproductive somewhat.
When we started, one of the first games Sean did when he first touched the platform, he replicated Atari 2600 Adventure. You guys all remember that one? The dragon that looked like a duck? That guy. Then we did Kaboom, right? The interesting thing about building things this way has been that each month we've kind of moved forward a year, right? So if we started out being able to build things from 1978 or 1979, a few months later we started building games that looked like they were from 82, and a couple of months later we were building games that looked like they were from 1990. Right now we're about up to, we're almost around 1995, I think.
Maybe 93. Maybe.
Somewhere in there. The good news is, just like one of Ray Kurzweil's graphs, we're moving faster than the years are. So I'm not sure what that means for where we eventually get to.
Eventually we catch up.
Eventually we catch up, and then hopefully what we see is with this extremely open system, people start doing stuff that you literally just can't do using standard game architectures. Because standard game architectures just don't talk to the web in the way that we do. And they just don't, you know, they just don't do things in as open a way. Now, plenty of things went wrong. And that's half the point of doing a talk like this, is sharing the mistakes. I sat on a plane. We were talking about, gosh, we want 2D animation to be cheaper. So I sat on a plane and I built this cool little prototype of a 2D skeletal animation system, kind of like one of those paper things that does this, you know. The prototype, it was one plane flight. I did it in like 4 or 5 hours. Somehow implementing it for production took...
Months.
So we scrapped it. Cut your losses, right? It's really easy to commit to this, which, you know, frankly, for, again, end users, 99% of them, all they need is stacking sprites, right? So building this cool, you know, skeletal animation system turned out to be radical overkill. It made the clients way more complicated to write. And nonetheless, even though lots of really smart people worked on it a long time, it was a pain in the ass. It was very difficult for us to get it nailed down tightly. We probably wasted months on that.
Yeah, and we built a bunch of tools for it at the same time, which we threw away as well.
Yeah, massive time sink. So the lesson on that one is, you know, move incrementally. Add the base capability first, then make it nicer, then make it nicer. Don't shoot for the, you know, really cool one that does the stuff that nobody's ever seen before. Work your way up to that. Someday somebody will need the skeletal animation system, but we'll be able to build it on top of the stuff we've got now rather than trying to jump straight to it. Second lesson was a thing that went wrong, was trying to get the web guys and the game guys to even speak the same language. Right?
Yes. Web guys make lots of assumptions and game guys make lots of assumptions, and then you come together and butt heads.
Yeah. Some specific ones. Oh, bandwidth usage, right? The web guys were somewhat horrified when they realized that when we named a bandwidth number, we meant, oh no, that is per second, every second.
For every user, all the time. Just presence, the way they measure concurrency in a website is a guy sitting there and every 30 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, he presses a button. It's not how WoW works. It's not how a multiplayer game works. The amount of people interacting with the system and the scale of the interactions are completely different.
The same thing was flipped around on us, right? So we were able to tell the web guys, no, this is what the parameters of that is, and here's how it's going to work in the end, right? But the flip side of that was when they came to us and said, you're going to do what for authentication?
Well, we're going to write this authentication server, and it's got to scale up, and it's got to implement all these protocols and stuff. And they were like, no. And we're using web sessions for authentication, and the clients talk web and negotiate a web session and pass a key, and it's done. And We didn't have to write an authentication server.
Yeah. So authentication servers usually take months. We posted the code for doing the auth handshake, and it's a screen long when you do it the web way, right? So it's interesting. It's not like the web is any less secure, right? The web is, they've got some hardcore stuff that happens with web authentication. You know, you do your banking with it, for example. So, you know, they certainly have a lot of the security questions tackled just in a way that's, they've already refined it down in a way that we were building these insanely complex systems.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting issue that we're still facing, actually, I still haven't built an MMORPG myself on it. And a lot of, you know, everybody's asking me, when are you building the spiritual successor to UO or whatever? The interesting thing about this is that a lot of our users want to build an MMORPG. And most users need to be able to use off-the-shelf pieces to do it. So this is something that we're facing now, that we need to build an awful lot of off-the-shelf pieces for end users for them to be able to assemble something. So we're working on that now. And I guess the key lesson there is have content people really early in the process. We probably had too few content people early on. And we really needed to have more people who are constantly exercising the pipelines. And don't be afraid to make content that you're just going to throw away.
And we didn't know. I mean, we thought there would be more platform services than there turned out to be. A lot of things that we thought would be platform services have become modules. So they've moved from the realms of us writing them in C++ to content developers writing them in a scripting language.
One big thing is, at one point we said, you know what? We're not a client company. We let end users write clients. Why are we maintaining many clients? So we picked one, which was the Flash client, and we said, this one is now the reference client. This one is the one that matters. When something is drawn on screen, all the other clients should look like this one. That was a massive mistake. A massive mistake, because it stopped us from staying honest. It meant that we could start cheating towards the direction of Flash. It also meant that if there was an error in the tag interpretation in Flash, we didn't have something else to compare it to. So we couldn't tell that our standard wasn't actually being implemented correctly, even by us. So because of this, we have relaunched our multi-client efforts, and we're now maintaining three clients all over again. And the last one is really about usability. So, I don't know if this talk was more or less geeky than you expected. I suspect it was far more geeky than you expected. It hasn't been a particularly user experience-centered talk, right? You can tell me whether that's a good thing or a bad thing later. But still circle the fives. One of the things that's really easy to do when you're building a platform like this is to think that your end user is a programmer. But the goal for MetaPlace is to come to a world... Why don't you switch over to the demo again? The goal for MetaPlace is to go create a world. So for you to come, hit this button... Log in again. For you to come, hit this button, choose a style sheet, click Woot, choose what kind of style sheet you want, world in a box, right? Name it. Breaks. And 30 seconds later, have built an MMO that we can log into. Right?
It's got its own web page. You can customize the web page with your own graphics. You can edit the descriptions.
Yeah. Click Build with Web Tools. This is an unplanned part of the demo. The thing is, that was a 30-second process to build an MMO that you can stick on a web page. This is actually a full-blown, capable of holding thousands of users, virtual world here, maybe.
Well, it's very small.
It is a very small world. Okay. It's
geographically too small to hold a few thousand, but server capacity can hold a few thousand. You can see down there the trag streams going by. You can see assets streaming in really slowly. The intent here is to get to the point where it's as easy for somebody to build their own virtual world as it is to play The Sims, right? And the lesson there was you always have to be interacting with ordinary people, ordinary users, rather than tool users here, because we ended up, this tool is not simple, right? You can see here there's templates and all that kind of thing. There, by the way, this is your applause line. We just built an MMO in less than 1 minute.
There's a chatbot running. It interacts with the web. We can go see what have I posted on my blog lately. Right?
So, you know, the intent here is an end user can do that and plug it on your own, you know, put it on your website. Right? Just drop it in. Anybody who comes to that web page is logged in transparently. So, sure, at the high end, people can come to this. They can script. They can write code and make chatbots and plug into stock quotes and, you know, do all of this crazy stuff. But it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that a lot of people just want to have a little virtual homestead that they can call their own. So we are currently spending basically an awful lot of time on making this stuff way, way, way easier. Because it's very easy to fall into the trap of building for programmers and making tools, in our case, that reflect back-end data structures rather than reflecting what the user wants to do. Where it should be more like the wizard, what I want is an apartment, click, go, hooray, than what I want to do is edit this piece of Lua script and integrate a dynamic table that, you know, whatever.
Right.
So moving to a task-based system in the tool creation.
All right. Should I go back?
Sure. So those are the lessons that we've learned so far from building this project. You know, I started building it in the summer of 06. We're up to 16 people now, plus some art contractors. And in 06, it was frankly completely freaking crazy to try to do. And I guess now we look at it and we go, this isn't nearly as crazy as we thought it was. Maybe we aimed too low, I don't know. But the lessons that we learned from this are, well, me personally, I am never going back to building games the old way ever, ever, ever again. Because it was just an amazing liberation from kind of the soul-destroying reinvention of the wheel grind that we've had. To date, we've had that little, just a little tidbit. That thing you saw with the real-time translation, we didn't write that. We didn't do that. An alpha tester did that. An alpha tester hooked up Eliza into a chatbot, right? An alpha tester is bridging to procedurally generated content. An alpha tester is doing things that fetch, you know, directions from Google Maps. An alpha tester is doing all of that kind of thing. And that's really what it's all about, because in the process of building something like this, it's not about what cool stuff we can make, right? It's about how do we bring the fun of this process to everybody else. Because they don't get to come to these shows. They don't get to see all these techniques. They sure as hell cannot model in, you know, in 3D with shaders and ZBrush and all the rest of that jazz, right? There's no way for them to do it. Someday I hope this platform does support doing all of that stuff for those who are capable. But the point isn't the people in this room. The point is the people who wish they could someday be in this room. Right? The point is the people who do not get to do what we did when we grew up, which was make games on these little 8-bit computers that have less power than what I carry around on my belt. We've lost that on-ramp for people. And so the goal with this is really to bring it back and let anybody get to do all the fun shit we get to do every day at work. So, all fives, remember? And if we can hang around here, I'm told. So we can answer questions. Via the microphone.
Hello.
Hello.
With such an open protocol, and the client gets to decide on how it implements a lot of stuff, how do you combat cheating and that sort of thing?
So the question was, how do you combat cheating when everything is so open? And fundamentally, the answer is, if you were relying on keeping things closed to combat cheating, you were kidding yourself anyway. Because you cannot keep anything closed. If you encrypt a protocol, you're actually handing the user a client that conveniently decrypts it. You know, shipping it to them. So encryption is mostly just a way to waste CPU cycles for somebody who's determined. You can't rely on security on a client end at all. So opening the protocol is not actually costing us anything in terms of real security. The security experts on the web will tell you security through obfuscation is a complete waste of time. The answer is you have to be secure on the server end.
Right. And it's interesting to note that the puzzle games, like casual games that we put on our platform, all the logic is running on the server. So unlike flash games running on your client, people can't cheat.
So I have two questions. First of all, am I understanding correctly that all non-player behaviors are objects making HTTP calls back to some server somewhere?
No. You can write behaviors in the scripting language, which is just an event-driven version of Lua. It will run inside the execution sandbox. It won't break any other scripts that are running. It's process limited, so it won't run. You can't do infinite loops in it, all that kind of thing. You can bridge, but you don't have to if you don't want to.
Right.
And secondly, how do you maintain that the tag space or whatever it is from going the way of HTML 3.0 as you're supporting all these different clients of different presentation layers?
That's the fallback system.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have user agents just like HTTP does, and be able to negotiate up and down into different capabilities of the protocol. But, yeah, I think there will be extensions eventually. I don't know if there's any other solution to that problem.
Yeah, I mean, maybe on the day that we take over the entire Internet, we might have to create, like, a standards consortium or something. But that's being very optimistic. So until then, we control the protocol, so we can keep it tight if we need to.
So you said that there's a lot of game services that people are asking for to do certain kinds of games like physics and stuff.
Could you speak up, please?
Speak up, we can't.
There's a lot of services that people are requesting to make their games that you need to build out. But you know, because of the nature of the platform you're working on, you know, the web, you could be working with other people on making those kinds of services. Are you working with anybody else? Or are you just doing it all sort of in-house?
We're not really making those web services.
I think he's asking about platform services.
Oh, platform services.
Right. So we are writing all those ourselves, or we're integrating open source technology into the server to provide them. And we've talked about ways of extending that to allow people to have a plug-in architecture on the back end of the server to provide new platform servers and even to have a... Can I keep talking about this?
Sure.
You know, a commercial partner program where we let people have their own plugin services that go into the back end of the server for providing real-time platform services, like high-end physics simulations or things like that.
So those don't go out to the web. They're all sort of built into the server platform, right?
Right.
Right okay. Now they are.
Okay.
Yeah. But eventually plugins. You know, the interesting thing is some users have started writing web services for... capabilities. Like, we currently don't support 3D. There are people who want to use 3D artist sources for sprites. So, a guy who isn't even in the alpha test yet has written a web service that does 3D rendering and spits out MetaPlace sprite sheets. All I know is his handle, Rococo. So,
Rococo?
Rococo, yeah. Oh, you upload a 3D mesh to him, he spits back all of the sprite sheets that you want. Well, it's really cool.
But I want to say, I first found out about you guys at the Orkut sandbox stuff for Open Social, and you guys are badass. We plug it into some of the JavaScript stuff. One other thing to look at, don't be so concerned about corrupted clients, because with part of what's happening with that is there's a whole Kaha project where there's a clean, secure JavaScript, but also with a lot of these clients, or I really hate the word client, let me say peer local servers, They've got SQLite databases there. You can do multi-user things where there's enough communication you can check from session management in like a high-speed 10 microsecond, 30 microsecond footprint in-memory database to local system doing interactions. And if you get enough result sets from people interacting in that space, you can check it by these people are competing against each other, and I'm getting three or four different confirmations in microsecond, 100 microsecond speeds. So you literally can do it that way and not have to worry about corrupted, what you're talking about, corrupted clients. And it's a good way to use, just like people use community to do things like check on Craigslist, which is just, you can do the same thing with corrupted clients or with people to make sure cheating isn't happening. So there's better architectural ways to do that. And then if you use client support, or I like to say user-contributed server architecture, you get apps that run really fast when more people load on, which for no more money, which is great too if you want to run stuff 0.1, 0.2 second on mobile or on what the edge.
I'm not sure there is an answer to that.
Hi, have you selected or are you leaning towards a particular browser-based 3D technology for rendering?
Have we selected a 3D technology for rendering in the browser? So, no, not really. 3D in a browser without a plugin, other than Flash, which is kind of almost not a plugin at this point because it's ubiquitous, is really not quite mature yet. There's a bunch of solutions that are out there that are plugin-based that are very functional, right? There's a Flux Player for Media Machines. There's a stuff from Vast Park. Wait, Vast Park? There's 3D Explorer. There's Scenecaster. There's Unity, there's Java 3D, there's Shockwave.
So hopefully we just do a specification for 3D and all of these people make 3D clients.
Yeah. When we do the first reference, we will be starting on that this year, I think. It's quite likely that we will still want it to run within a browser with no plugin. And that means, you know, keeping an eye on things like the work that Firefox is doing with OpenGL and Canvas, and of course the new announcements with Flash 10 that Adobe has made about 3D polygon transforms. And of course the most likely candidate if we pursue that would be PaperVision 3D.
And by the way, we're looking to hire a 3D graphics programmer.
Yeah, you're a 3D graphics guy. We'd talk to you if you think this is cool stuff to work on.
This looks great. My only question is, do you anticipate any legal problems with aggregating other people's information from other websites? Like, you had the translation from French. That was done somewhere else on the web, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how are you handling using other people's material?
Wow. That question is interesting because it reveals kind of the cultural gap. The reason why Alta Vista put that API on the web was so that we could do that. Right? Usually the way the web handles that is that they have an API key that you need to get. So you register for an API key and you sign an agreement not to abuse the access, not to do it too much. Often many of the web services let you enter into commercial agreements with them so that you have broader access to the API. So Flickr does that, Amazon does that, and so on. Basically, a lot of the web is about giving away functionality in order to get even more. So we actually have on our wiki, why don't we throw up the wiki just while we talk? We actually have on our wiki a list of free and open web services that anybody can use, that other people are just saying, hey, use this, right? This is the foundation of what the web is built on, right, is these open APIs. So, from a legal point of view, it's just following the usage policies of the creator of the API.
Right, so API keys let you identify who is making the requests, and if one person abuses that, then you can either shut down their API key or start charging them for use from that API key. And we'll use a similar model for that kind of thing.
So like, for example, in that situation there, it's each user is hitting Alta Vista individually. It's not you guys hitting Alta Vista.
No, our server is hitting Alta Vista.
Your server is hitting Alta Vista.
Well, it's actually your server is hitting Alta Vista.
Oh, right.
So it's your API key that you put in there.
Right, I see. All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have like a multi-tiered question, but it's really quick, I promise. In terms of like managing content that people create, particularly for like commercial use, are you going to have some kind of, first of all, featured content, some way to filter out the crap and the cool stuff? And are you offering some kind of service to people who are doing commercial projects using your platform in order to become featured or to stand out from the crowd? And also, as kind of sort of connected to that, are you going to have your own like official worlds or whatever that you're going to have in there as well?
Okay, so first, that space for sale, right?
Gotcha.
Absolutely. We actually, looks like the popular worlds is currently broken, but we do, pretty much we ripped off the front page of YouTube.
Right.
They seem to have
ratings.
All the best practices on that. So there's, yeah, there's ratings, there's reviews, we can surface content, you can be fans of people, you can follow the work that they do, all of that kind of thing, right? So absolutely. Those kinds of advanced search and tagging features and all of that are really, really, really important. The badge thing, by the way, is basically kind of like achievements. Worlds get a budget of badges that they can give people. So yeah, absolutely. There is plenty of like potential business models surrounding stuff like that, but obviously it depends on us actually being successful and getting big. And the second half of your question was...
I was just wondering if you're if you guys yourselves are going to be doing any kind of official worlds that will
yes.
be like portals or what would those entail? Would those be games or would they just be like social portals with like portals to other worlds? Like I remember playing a game called Furcadia way back when that had something like that. Is that what you're envisioning, or what would you guys do for your official worlds?
So actually, all the worlds that we showed you today are worlds that we made. So, yes, we are making worlds. We have internal content teams. We've been doing puzzle worlds. We did a photo gallery world. We did a movie theater world, right? I mean, we're not trying to stick to any one kind of world because there are so many different possible things. If you could explore the category tree, you would find things like church group in our category tree. So part of the reason to even have a category tree is just to suggest to people what the potential for what they could be doing is. So, yes, we are making content of a variety of sorts. We are making a fair amount of entertainment content because we do believe 90% of people will just want to come here and find something to do, right? And if there's a flaw with a lot of the social worlds out there today is that there's nothing to do, right? I mean, we're game people. We ought to be capable of giving them something fun to do. So we are making games. The ones we've showed you are some of those, and we've got a bunch of others that are in there. Talking about buying stuff on Overstock. Anyway, now they are kicking us out. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
I have one guy.
One last guy.
He's waiting patiently. Go.
All right. From what you showed today, it looks like the worlds that users are creating are getting hosted on your machines at your data center. Will that always be true? And will you charge users? If I make a world that becomes very popular, now I have hundreds of thousands of users. I'm using your bandwidth, your trap, mm-hmm. your servers, your data center. Is that part of your business model? Could you comment mm-hmm. on that?
Two answers to that, I guess. One, we hope eventually that worlds are hosted wherever. This is designed to just sit alongside Apache installs anywhere on the web. Two, yes, we host, and yes, we can charge money off of it. It's an obvious kind of candidate, especially for users who don't know how to go get hosting, don't know how to set up a box or whatever. I suspect that will always be there, and obviously it's a possible revenue source.
Is that the main part of your business model, or is there another way you see to monetize this?
It's a fairly substantial part of the business model, but there's lots of pieces in this, obviously, you can tell, that we can monetize. And honestly, we're going to try them all.
So anywhere on that chart on the web, people are making money on all of those places right now. People who are writing HTML editing tools, people are running DNS services, all of the same analogous business models, in theory, apply to virtual worlds.
Thank you.
All right, I guess that's all we have time for. Thank you.